Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Brian Castle is the CEO and founder of Four Star Wealth Advisors, an SEC-registered investment advisor firm headquartered in Chicago. Brian holds an MBA from the University of Chicago's Booth School of Business and has been a guest lecturer for their MBA program. Brian, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Great to be here, Sam.
Hey, the pleasure's all mine. I'm excited about today's episode because I think you can present some viewpoints that maybe a lot of the guests that we have on here aren't going to just have the depth of experience that you do to present on. So I'm excited about jumping in today. I've got three questions I ask the same people, same questions to every person that comes on the show. Can you briefly tell us, where did you start? Where are you now? And how did you get there?
Sure. So I'm a little more vintage than maybe some of your guests. I've been in the financial advisory industry since 1983 after college. And back then we were stockbrokers. Then we're financial advisors. Now we're investment managers. So things kind of progressed and changed over time. But then I was at Payne Weber. I've been at Lehman Brothers, partner at William Blair & Company in Chicago, Morgan Stanley. And then in 2014, I did, like many senior producers, left and started their own firm, essentially. So we're creating a firm that's a national firm now. We're in four states, and then we're bringing advisors on and acquiring other firms. So we're going to be a national brand over the next 5 years. We're kind of a semi-national brand already, but that's how I built it. I did an MBA at University of Chicago along the way, opened a lot of doors. So we're having a lot of fun with it. We've done a lot of work building a national firm with what advisors and clients need. And that's where we are today.
That's fantastic. If we have time at the end of this show, I want to dig into the mechanics of how you built that national firm and kind of what that growth and trajectory and just the struggles and successes you've had doing that. I'd love to dig in on that if we have time. But before we get into even wrap up with that, let's talk about the main reason we came on this show, which is really to get your view on the markets, to get your view on commercial real estate, what you guys are doing for investors. Let's just break this thing down and really dig inside your head and hear what you see happening today.
Sure. Well, talking about the financial markets, we were going along in a very orderly economy in the last administration, and we probably had the best economy in American history prior to the pandemic. Lowest unemployment, fastest growth we've seen in 30 years. So a lot of things are going on really well. Pandemic started, and then part of our reaction was to create an environment where we shut down about 40% of our economy, and it was devastating to the economy, devastating to the markets. And so naturally, we saw an extremely quick decline, the fastest decline of 35% in American history, and the market was just a complete panic. And so then we recovered from that. But a lot of people made plenty of mistakes during that process. Now we're back above there and we're going on and we have an economy that's recovering, but we did throw a lot of money at it to make sure we didn't completely fall off the end of the cliff. So in a period of a year and a half between the previous administration and now the current Biden administration and the Federal Reserve, we put about $12 trillion into our economy. We've never done anything like that, Sam. I mean, it's really mind-boggling when you think of the assistance that they gave to the economy. And maybe they did too much. They might have done too much. There's so much money the Fed has authorized that is sitting on the books of the banks, and they're not lending it. It's just sitting there. And then there's a lot of stimulus money that isn't going to come out for the next year or two. Then we maybe don't need that anymore. We probably need to end the stimulus. In fact, for the last 6 months, some of the stimulus programs like the extra surcharge on unemployment benefits, the PPP programs, they were pretty much figured out in the last couple of months. It was actually slowing the economy down because we did a podcast episode, Sam, where we talked about how the best stimulus is a job. And it's a little provocative to say that, but that in the end is probably true. People are out working, paying taxes, paying their rent. Those are the right things to do. So bottom line is the economy is recovering. We went off a lot of the stimulus programs on Labor Day weekend. So now we'll see over the next couple of months what happens to all that. I think it'll be very positive. I think it was becoming a negative that we had so much stimulus. It was too much. So the markets continue to go up, and we see no reason for them to go down right now. Maybe they're not going to spike higher, but we should see a continuing rising financial markets. But since there's so much money out there, we're seeing inflation, and that could be a problem for the economy. We're seeing auto prices are up big. So many in goods, food is up 4%. That's big for food. My favorite is bacon is up 13% in the last year, you know. And then we're also seeing inflation in stock prices. That's partly what it is. And also in real estate prices, right, Sam?
That's your department. Yeah, in our department, absolutely. I mean, it's crazy what is happening right now. So that's really interesting. What do you mean when you say maybe we stimulated too much? And what would be the effect of that?
Well, if there's so much stimulus, then people have no incentive to go back to work. There were literally millions of people getting large checks from the government. There was a period of time there where a couple, husband, wife, or two husbands, two wives, however you play it these days, could be at home and they could get between benefits and cash from the government over $80,000 a year in benefits. So some people are like, why would I go to work?
Yeah. Why would you? I mean, for the majority of Americans, why would you possibly go to work?
Right.
I mean, that doesn't make any sense. Yeah. And we've seen that, of course, even the labor shortages, which we're not short on people that could work. We're short on people who are willing to work.
There's 10 million jobs posted right now, the largest available jobs in American history. And then there's a lot of people at home on the couch. So there's a disconnect there and we need to end that disconnect, right?
Oh, gosh. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, when McDonald's entry level job is paying $15 an hour plus,
right?
It's like, okay, so that's 30 something thousand bucks a year. I mean, you don't have to present any decided skill to get the job. It's just you need to show up and be able to figure things out and go to work. So,
and now with some of those programs being canceled, well, then the normal unemployment is still there. And there's still 24,000, I think, is what you can make. But that's not a real living in America now. So that's going to give people the impetus to get off the couch and go back to work, hopefully.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I love your quote there that the best stimulus is a job. So that's great. Let's talk a little bit about what you guys do on diversification strategies, how you see people taking their portfolios today. Where are you putting people right now that you feel is a good place to be? And then how are you mixing their investments to be well diversified?
Sure. Well, I mean, the standard investor has a portfolio of 60-40, right? 60% of growth investments and 40% of safe bucket that could be bonds, CDs, things like that. So that's kind of like the framework that most people work around. Some riskier people will have higher allocations of growth and some less. And we always tell investors and counsel them, they should only take the risk they need to meet their goals. So it's really goals-based rather than how do we get the best return? You get the return you need to meet your goals. And if you can do it all without being in stocks or risky things, then maybe you should do that, right? You don't need to take risk if you don't need to. So it depends on what your objective is. So we'll do a review with a family and go fully comprehensive and say, okay, where are we going with this? How much cash flow do you need? Do you have a pension? Do you have Social Security? And we do a full analysis of their cash flows and come up with a probability of them achieving their goals and then ratchet the risk down to a level that they need and no more. Now, if they want more, then we'll have to change the risk level. But that's how we do it. And then within that framework, they select investments, whether it be U.S. stocks, international stocks, maybe commodity related real estate, which is a big subject here. And then bonds, interest rates are really low. Some people are saying, I don't like my bonds anymore, and they're moving into stocks. And that, if you do too much of that, that would be a mistake, because just because stocks are doing better doesn't mean you put it all in stocks. Stocks can go down, as we've seen, right? So there's different things you can do with bond money that wouldn't take stock risk.
What do you mean by that?
So there are alternative investing programs where you can generate income, where some of that money will be invested a little bit longer, a couple, 2 to 5 years. But if that money is going to be at 2 to 5 years sitting in bonds with interest rates low, so maybe you can put some of that in illiquid investments and get a 5, 6, or 7% cash flow and maybe get a little better return. It's not the same risk level as bonds, but it clearly is money that you don't want to put it all in the stock market. So maybe there's other things you can do, like a multifamily real estate where there's quarterly income, that kind of thing.
How does an advisory firm like yours participate in commercial real estate opportunities? Because I know maybe we can get into this. You guys aren't the big brokerage houses, right? You go to the big houses and none of them are going to say, please go do a syndication with sponsor XYZ. How do you guys participate in that?
So there are plenty of real estate companies that create partnerships that individual investors can invest in. And when you go to the wirehouses like a Merrill or a Morgan or a UBS or Wells Fargo, they do have some programs like that. But because of their structure, it's hard for them to create a program that everybody in the country can invest in because all real estate is local. So a lot of the projects are smaller. Even the commercial real estate projects are smaller. And a big firm like that couldn't offer it to everybody because it would be not big enough, right? So the smaller investment firms actually have an advantage there to some extent. When you work with a smaller investment firm, an independent firm, we're SEC regulated. So there's a series of regulations under which we can offer those programs, Reg A and Reg D, and they're designed to make sure there's proper due diligence for the investor and that the program is structured properly. Then you still need to diversify, but there's programs in multifamily, apartment building, home building, commercial real estate, and then a whole series of other programs. Cannabis is a hot subject right now, and you can invest in wind and solar energy, wireless assets, all series of different businesses in the private market to create cash flow. And that would be a replacement for some of your bond money, maybe.
Right. Walk us through that from the mechanics side of it. I know you say there's, you use the term programs, but I'm having trouble with the connection between, say it's me, right? Regular sponsor, we buy multifamily properties. How does your client get invested in a project like mine? Can they get invested in a project like mine? Or is there an intermediary that we have to go through in order to make that work?
Yeah. So the investment group that offers through investment advisors like us, an SEC registered investment advisor, would have to go through the process to get that project registered through the Regulation A or Regulation D, and then right. Process. And then you set up a partnership and then you make an offering and say, we're going to raise $50 million or $100 million, right, for this program. And then they set up minimum investor. They either accredited investor or a qualified investor, different levels of net worth, right? So the very small investor, and some of these are not eligible because there's a higher risk level, right?
Right.
So accredited investors, an income of $200,000 a year or $300,000 for 1 year. So it's not a very high test for some investors, but nonetheless, you have to reach that accredited level. And so then they may have a $25,000 minimum. So if you're saying I have a portfolio of maybe $1 million and I have stocks and I have bonds and different things, so maybe 15 to 20% of that portfolio could be put in illiquid investments like real estate, like what you're talking about. But you also want to diversify that segment. So if that's $200,000 or $150,000, you want to buy 5 to 10 investments, not just one, right? Just like stocks, you want to diversify that segment too. So maybe you'll put 10,000 in 10 different programs or 15,000 in 7 programs or something like that. That way you're diversified. And then the cash flow comes to your account. We set it all up so it does that. And that's how you invest. Most of them are illiquid. You may have some forms of liquidity after a year or two or five. And then a partnership has a term. So it may terminate after 5 years and then they refinance it with some other investor, something like that.
Right. Understood on that side. That makes a lot of sense. Does the sponsor compensate your firm or do you guys then charge management fees to the actual investor?
Well, in the broker world, they make commissions, but in the investment advisor world, we don't make any commissions. We charge fees for our work. So most investment advisors either have some sort of a platform fee that's ongoing, a service fee, and that's what we charge. It's usually anywhere from 0.5% to 1% of the offering. And then there's a lot of service, a lot of paperwork, a lot of details. And so that's what we charge, right? And then the investment group usually has a management fee internally, but that's all handled at that level. If you do it through a broker, they'll often sell it to you on a commission basis, and then that's that much less money that goes in. So we have an advantage over brokers that since we don't charge commission, more money goes into the program and you can break even quicker and better.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. From an end user, from being, if they were a client of yours, your program would be better just because there's, like you said, if they're going through a broker, then they may pay, I don't know what those fees are. So you put $100,000 into a deal and suddenly all you've got is 93 actually being employed.
That's right.
And that takes a little bit of time to make up for that lost ground.
Usually a year or two. Yeah,
right. That's a really important distinction there. One of the things that we talked about off air that I'm excited for you to jump into is the phrase you used, how not to be stupid. So I'm taking copious notes on this side of the microphone. If you can educate me on how not to be stupid, I'd be grateful. What does that mean to you?
Well, a little tongue in cheek, but naturally people react to the current environment they're in and they make decisions based on the things they see today. So when interest rates are really low and you have 40% of your portfolio in bonds, and the next bond you're going to buy is at 1.2%. You're like, well, that's not exciting. Or CDs aren't exciting. And someone else says, oh, I'll give you a 4% or 5% over here. And you really don't scrutinize it very much. You say, oh, I like four better than one. Well, okay, yeah, we all like four better than one. But is it the right thing? Is it related? Is there a risk to it? A good example of that is the REIT market. So the real estate investment trust market usually has higher cash flows. But if people look at the REIT market, there are big, big declines in REITs when all the REITs collectively go down 30, 40%. So it's not a CD, it's not a bond, and you got to be, to not be stupid, right, is what we're saying, is make sure that you understand the risk of these extra cash flow programs. There are some where you invest in a corporate credit program where they're going to give you your principal back, and that's the intended. It's almost like a bond. But there's risk of credit issues. Nonetheless, you could lose some money in it, but the general intention is that you're going to get your money back and you're going to get 5 or 7% return. And as long as you understand that's the program and then you're willing to take some of that risk, then that's fine. But a lot of folks will see some security like a market traded REIT or a high yielding company and not consider the principal risk. So that's the stupid part, is to just dive in because one number is better than the other and not thinking about it.
I like that. That makes a heck of a lot of sense. And it's, I don't know if you ever read Howard Marks. I think one of his books I just recently read was Mastering the Market Cycle.
Yeah.
And he talks a lot. He spends a bulk of that book talking about just investor psychology.
Right.
And how investors typically go, they jump in at the exact wrong times. Like, oh, everybody's piled in. They're like, oh, well, everybody else is piling. I should pile in. And he's like, actually, it should be the other way around. Like, you see everybody piling in, you should probably getting out. And then when they're all getting out, you should probably be getting in.
Probably getting in. All the studies show that investors make decisions with kind of a one-year time frame. Like, whatever's happened in the last year is what they think will continue to happen. So when the market's down, most people are looking down. They think it's going further down. And when the market's up, everyone thinks it's continuing to go up. And that isn't always the case, right? We call that recency bias. Whatever recently happened is going to continue to happen. And I think you need to look past that and figure out, okay, well, if the market's really, really cheap, maybe it's an opportunity. And if the market's really expensive, maybe I should pull some cards off the table, right? And so to manage that through a process is smart to do.
How do you guys talk investors off the proverbial cliff of either getting in at the wrong time or getting out at the wrong time? I would imagine you spend a fair amount of your time doing that.
We do. Well, and we have a process, Sam, at Four Star. We call our Four Star Protection Program. So in addition to running, we're an investment manager also. So about half of the money at the firm is run by our team as well. In addition to being the investment counselor and wealth manager, we also are the investment manager. We run the portfolios. And of the growth money, about 80% of it is in some form of program that rotates out of the market. So when things start to get rough, and we see a market declining substantially, then we'll start to raise cash and get out. And then the market can go down however far it's going to go down. We'll just sit there with a heavy cash position and wait until we see a bottom. The market's always bottom at some point. And usually that's the highest stress point. Everyone's panicked. But if you're sitting with a lot of cash, you're not in as much a panic. You're waiting for an opportunity. And we've done that now. I've been an investment advisor for 27 years and chief investment officer of our firm still. And we've only done that maneuver 5 times in my career because it doesn't happen all the time, right? And very oftentimes when there's a market crash, you've forgotten what happened because it was 5 or 7 years ago, right? So we have a model that will protect folks on the downside. It's not foolproof, but generally when the market goes down about 10 to 15%, that's when we're starting to take protection. And if it continues to go down, well, then we're protected at that point from that point on down. If it goes down 20% or 50%, eventually it will bottom and then we'll slowly get back in. And then you're getting in feeling comfortable that you have cash and you're not in as big a panic because all your other stocks aren't down 50%. Right. So that's how we do it. It's a rotation feature and we call it our protection plan.
That's awesome. Yeah, that sheds a lot of light on that. And I'm sure that helps. Probably keeps a lot of phone time down for you guys talking to investors who are watching the daily moves and panicking.
Reality is we're investment managers in there every day making decisions on the portfolios, all the granular buys and sells and everything. And they're all based on different models and different objectives. But we really don't know where the market's going to go. Right now, we believe it's going to continue to go up because of current conditions. But if those conditions change, markets could go down. Sam, about 85% of the time, the markets are going up in a normal kind of orderly, quiet fashion, right? Maybe some big up days, then we'll have a little correction, but then it comes back up again. And then about 15% of the time, we're in correction or crash mode, right? And that's when you need to take protection. So the system we design gives us a very high probability of finding, not foolproof, but finding those big declines and trying to protect against it. That's all.
Right. That makes a heck of a lot of sense. I've certainly enjoyed this. This has been a lot of fun, Brian. Thanks for coming on today.
My pleasure.
I know we're a little over time, but I want to talk quickly about creating a national firm. Maybe you can tell us the greatest pleasure or success you've found in doing that, and maybe what has been the biggest challenge on that front.
Well, doing an acquisition of another firm is a big challenge. It involves financing and then dealing with all the different personalities. Managing portfolios isn't as hard as managing people. And as you grow, whatever you're trying to do as an entrepreneur, you can't do it alone. So you need a great team of people around you. And I think we do have a great team, but there's probably $100,000 we spent on things we wish we hadn't, that kind of thing, right? So every entrepreneur makes mistakes, but as long as you keep it to a minimum and you keep growing, it should work out if you keep at it. So we're in 4 states now, and we're doing some other acquisitions currently that will hopefully make the firm full 20 to 25 states over the next 3 to 5 years. So.
That's fantastic. I love the vision and I love just the execution of that vision. I know it takes a lot of hard work and time to get things like that done. Brian, thanks for coming on today. I do appreciate it. I've got the final 4 questions, the same 4 questions I ask everybody who comes on the show, no matter what industry you're involved in. So here's first question number one. If I gave you $20,000 to invest in real estate with no previous real estate investing experience, what would you do with it and why?
Well, $20,000, it depends on whether you have your own home or not. Probably the first thing you should do is invest in your own home. And if that's enough for a down payment in certain markets, then I would do that. If you're not at that point, then I'd probably pick a couple different partnerships that you can invest in and grow in real estate. Maybe not all the same kind, maybe a little bit of commercial, a little bit of multifamily, that kind of thing. That's what I would do.
I love that. Great answer. Question number two, if you could help our listeners avoid just one mistake in real estate, what would it be and how would you avoid it?
To not get over levered. The easy way to lose everything in real estate is to use too much leverage. And we saw that in a very painful way in 2005 to 2012 in the worst bear market in real estate in America's history, where people coughed up their houses and many people unfortunately had to go bankrupt because of it. So make sure that you have a little more equity in your home. And just because they'll let you buy it with no money down doesn't mean you should.
Right. Well said. Third question is this. When it comes to investing in the world, what's one way you're making the world a better place?
Well, I'm involved in a lot of nonprofits. One thing Four Star does is we're also a philanthropic advisor. So I'm on the trustee of the National Foundation of the Boy Scouts of America, which is a great organization, training people in character and citizenship and using outdoor activity as the main focus, camping and scouting. So that's my thing is scouting.
That's awesome. I love it. Brian, if our listeners want to get in touch with you, what is the best way to do that?
Sure. Well, on our website, 4starwealth.com, you can call me directly at 312-667-1755 or B. Castle, my last name, K-A-S-A-L at 4starwealth.com. Anybody wants to contact us, let us know. We're happy to work with you. We'll find you a good advisor and help you out with what you need.
Brian, thank you so much. I do appreciate it.
Thanks, Sam.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen, If you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much, and hope to catch you on the next episode.